back at the links between South Africa and Palestine and the collaboration between South Africa's previous apartheid regime and the Zionist entity.
South Africa has taken the step to invoke the Genocide Convention and charge Israel in the International Court of Justice. While there are severe limitations to this process, it is undeniably momentous to see Israel brought before the highest international court to answer for its crime of genocide against the Palestinians. The relationship between South Africa and Palestine is deep and cannot be underestimated. It was forged through oppression and racial subjugation. Israel was a key player in the development and later the malignancy of apartheid rule in South Africa. South Africa's apartheid prime minister, Daniel Malan, was the first foreign prime minister to visit Tel Aviv following the Nakba. Hendrik Verwoerd, a South African apartheid architect and prime minister, even claimed in 1961 that Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. That was six decades before Amnesty International said the same. In order to improve the image of apartheid in South Africa, Israel and the apartheid authorities established a joint secretariat for political and psychological warfare in 1975. By 1981, the apartheid army in South Africa had 200 Israeli military advisors, and hundreds of apartheid troops were also educated in Israeli military academies. Israeli military instructors provided direct guidance to the South African Reconnaissance Commando's elite unit in particular. Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms business, played a key role in the development of South Africa's military electronics industry. South Africa's naval forces were also trained in Israel and sold radar systems by ELTA, a subsidiary of the state-owned Israeli Aerospace Industries. Israel was also essential to the construction of an electric wall to police the border of apartheid South Africa, with a crew of 50 Israeli technicians stationed permanently at the wall for maintenance. The Israelis also planted radar devices and minefields along the border. Israeli intelligence agencies had a steady presence in apartheid-era South Africa. The apartheid intelligence agency BOS ran a letter bomb campaign against ANC figures like Ruth First, which employed similar methods in its Operation Wrath of God against Palestinians in Lebanon. It is thought likely that Israel provided support for this. The Israel spy agency, the ADL, also spied on many anti-apartheid activists, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and sold the information to BOS agents of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Israel and apartheid South Africa worked closely on nuclear research, with South African uranium proving extremely useful to Israel's covert nuclear program. Are we witnessing the revenge of history?
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David is also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest contributor today is Sam Hosseini, who joins us from Washington, D.C. via Skype. Sam is a Palestinian-American independent journalist who's been piercing through the establishment's falsifications for more than 25 years. He formerly worked for the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and he's contributed to a variety of publications, including The Washington Post, USA Today, and Counterpunch. And as the senior analyst at the Institute for Public Accuracy, he's been writing for at least a decade about the case for invoking the Genocide Convention against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Welcome to the show. David, do you think Israel's history in supporting apartheid in South Africa had a role in this move?
Well, this is the revenge of history, and you can see in the demeanour and the cheers that went up when the South African legal team came back from The Hague, that this is seen as being a kind of an atonement for the sins of apartheid. And of course, the hand held out to the Palestinian resistance and to the Palestinian people is a mark of how the South Africans see their struggle intertwined with that of the Palestinians. As of course you said at the beginning, from that famous quote from Nelson Mandela, you know, who whatever else you might say about Mandela, and, you know, he's seen as this big, you know, saint in a way, and of course you can criticise his views, but whatever else you say about him, he was sold on the Palestinians.
Absolutely, and there's pressure on him not to be so when he was released, and he stood firm. But Sam, I mean, you were one of the first people pushing for a state to invoke the Genocide Convention, as I was saying in the introduction there. What convinced you that there was merit in pushing for this?
Several things. First off, I actually first really looked into this possibility in 2014 during the Israeli assault then, and I was in touch with the late Michael Ratner, who was then head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Francis Boyle, who had represented the PLO and who had been advocating a move like this, because he did this for Bosnia in the 1990s. So he had been through this process of going to the ICJ and invoking the Genocide Convention. In addition, I had been tracking the International Criminal Court and its machinations and its refusal to do anything for the Palestinians or to in any way genuinely polarize with U.S. Dictates. And then you had so I actually wrote my first piece on my Substack, I think on October 8th, it had multiple points about what was going to come down the line, which I think held up pretty well. And one of those things was saying that a country should immediately invoke the Genocide Convention. I had hoped that if a country had done so immediately, it might have prevented Israel from doing what it's done for the last 3 months. And then at a certain point, you had the prosecutor for the ICC go to the crossing between Egypt and Gaza as if to say, I'm the cop on the beat here, send your complaints to me. And a lot of people fell for that, thinking that the ICC would actually be of help. So I immediately knew that meant that an alternative mechanism had to be done, because a lot of people were you know, taken down a false path.
Yeah, yeah. Well, David, I mean, our report there, he pointed out that Elbit, which, as you know, is Israel's largest arms company, had a role in supporting apartheid in South Africa, and many of the war crimes being perpetrated by Israel today are likely being committed using Elbit weapons, aren't they?
Well, of course they are. And of course, Elbit has many plants throughout the UK and in other countries too. And of course, a couple of them have been shut down by Palestine Action through their amazing activism. But, you know, here we are, and people talk about boycotting McDonald's for their supply to the IDF. And of course, that's a good idea. But Elbit are actually producing weapons in this country, which are being used day and daily to kill Palestinians, over 100 children every single day. And it's an extraordinary position that we're in. And what we're faced with is the minister here, Grant Shapps, was saying just the other day that, you know, that Ansar Allah and Yemen, it's nothing to do with Israel-Palestine. Yes. It's far away. It's thousands of kilometres away, you know, several thousand kilometres less than the UK is, of course. But, of course, this is absolutely to do with what's going on. And it's being done in the UK. Mm. And it should be stopped forthwith. The government should step in and say, you can't do this anymore. I mean, the government should be enforcing this, but of course it's left to the extraordinary work of Palestine Action, which of course everyone should join and support. And
of course, we had that enormous rally in Yemen, didn't we, in Sanwar city, you know, supporting the action being taken in solidarity with the Palestinian people. So for Jack Gratz to say what he was saying, I mean, it just clearly trying to pull all the wool over the public's eyes in this country. But Sam, how did you feel when you heard South Africa took the step to invoke the convention after you'd been, you know, pressing for it for so long?
Yeah, no, it was extraordinary. You know, I'd gotten wind about maybe 6 weeks ago that there was a cabinet meeting in South Africa, because the parliament had wanted the cabinet to totally cut off relations with Israel, not just simply recall the ambassador. And I was fairly sure that they were also considering invoking the Genocide Convention. So I was very disappointed for some time that they didn't issue a statement after that cabinet meeting that they would be invoking the Genocide Convention. But reconstructing the timeline, it's quite possible that they had made that decision and that they had just simply been working on this 84-page application to do it as comprehensively as possible. And then they finally issued it, and I was overwhelmed. I had spent my energies focusing on some Latin American countries at this point, Colombia, Bolivia, some others to possibly this, criticizing the Palestinian ambassadors for not publicly declaring their support for this, and so on. So it's been tremendous. And just about that time that the South Africans did that, a whole bunch of groups in the United States, I think, woke up to the possibility of the efficacy of this. And so you have a coalition now trying to get other countries to issue declarations.
Absolutely, yeah. But David, I mean, just say a word or two, will you, about the level of international support that there is for the case that South Africa's taken against Israel?
I think you've got to look at this in two ways. One is, when you say international support, of course, there's the question of states parties supporting this. And of course, it was South Africa at first, and it was only them for quite a while, and then all of a sudden a trickle of other countries joined, Bolivia amongst them, and then of course latterly Bangladesh joins, and you've got a whole list of countries, I think around about 20 now, possibly more.
Any Western countries?
No Western countries, no. And you have also, let's be clear, these are largely countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, not Arab countries. Now, of course, that's the rub, isn't it? Because it should be the Arab countries that should be involved, and Islamic countries that should be at the forefront of this. And that takes you to the second question, which is, of course, the international support for South Africa in public opinion. And that is, of course, overwhelming all over the world in every single country, with the exception, of course, of Israel.
Yeah.
So even overwhelming in the US. So but what we see then is the step that South Africa has taken provides the way in for people to say, what are our, especially in the Arab world, what are our governments doing? I saw a massive demonstration in Cairo just the other day where they're saying, this brings shame upon us.
Yes,
South Africa is leading the way. It brings shame upon us that we haven't done this.
Absolutely. We're going to come back in a moment to the discussion, but we've got another report now about the proceedings at the ICJ.
As the proceedings at the International Court of Justice began and South Africa laid out their case, the world looked on with hope. The South African legal team, featuring an Irish lawyer, meticulously constructed a compelling case that Israel has breached the Genocide Convention with its campaign in Gaza. However, as the hearing was taking place, Israel attacked civilian locations in two separate countries. An ambulance and health services building in South Lebanon in the town of Hanin, and civilians queuing for food in Gaza. At least 32 Palestinians, including women, children, and men, were then killed by the Israeli army in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza Strip, with an airstrike during the International Court of Justice session. Clearly unashamed of Israel's warmongering ways, Israeli lawyers took to the International Court of Justice the following day to further attempt to justify the unjustifiable. Israel's lawyer, Malcolm Shaw, from Leicester University in Britain, came across as unorganized and arrogant. "Someone has shuffled my papers," he grumbled as he staggered through his address. A widely criticized move took place when Western news channels that ignored South Africa's presentation at the International Court of Justice live-streamed Israel's response to it in an act of censorship by omission. The German government has announced that it will seek to intervene in the International Court of Justice to support Israel. Possibly out of dread for its own fate, as German armament sales to Israel soared 1,000% in 2023, with a fast-tracking system established in October. As a result, Germany not only continued to arm Israel throughout its murderous war in Gaza, but even increased sales to boost Israel's ability to kill. Former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, argued the result of the trial at The Hague will define the integrity of the institution. Israel is not on trial here. What's on trial is actually the International Court itself.
David, I mean, they say that one of the hardest aspects to prove in cases like this at the ICJ is intent. But, I mean, there's been a plethora, hasn't there, of statements from Zionist leaders that do justify the accusation of genocide. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you say a plethora. I mean, what's the plural of plethora? I mean, there have been so many. And we've talked about this in the programme before, you know, listing statement after statement. Netanyahu talking about Amalek, the people of Amalek being smited by... and, of course, that passage is from Scripture. And you know, Netanyahu, of course, is an atheist and the Zionist, by and large, are secularist. There's a religious Zionist fringe. But they're talking about there is, in that passage in the Bible, is when they say smiting the Amalek, they're talking about killing everybody and everything, the goats, the chickens, the hens, the men, the women, and the children, every single one. Yeah. And that's, of course, an incitement to genocide. And, of course, what they've had to show in South Africa is that this is an incitement to genocide and it's been carried out. And of course, they've done that very effectively by showing the IDF in Gaza jumping up and down, talking about wanting to kill the Gazans. So there's an absolutely clear-cut case. Yeah. Of course, the response from Israel is to say, well, these are just some politicians. They're not really important. And, of course, these are the politicians who are in charge.
Indeed,
I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, no, indeed. Sam, I mean, what do you make of Germany vowing to come to Israel's aid?
Yes, well, you know, they're batting 1,000, I suppose, the Germans. You had the very, very interesting response by the Namibians, given the history of German massive oppression of Namibia, chime in very effectively. And it's quite possible that Namibia will counter with a declaration at the court. You had Bangladesh and Colombia state that they will do so. You've had about 30 countries make some kind of statements regarding the court, but a few of them have said that they will issue actual legal declarations. So it's important that more of them do that as soon as possible, I believe. But you have this pattern of the West, you know, and obviously not just Germany, but, you know, you fully expect the British government, the U.S. government, of course, has been completely dismissive of what South Africa has done, that continue this imperialist posture, basically, of enabling and being complicit with Israel's crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. David, I mean, what's your assessment of the performance at the ICJ of Israel's representative? What's his name? Malcolm Shaw. I mean, it was quite extraordinary, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, he's got a tough hand to play, and he played it very badly. So, you know, I mean, there he is. Like you saw in the film there, shuffling his papers, not sure where he was. And he actually said in the court, you know,
yes,
has someone shuffled my papers?
Indeed. This is supposed to be a top QC.
KC. I mean, and there we are. That's the best that Israel could come up with. But, you know, of course, it's a very difficult hand to play because everybody in the world can see that this is a genocide, and there's no question about that. And we have to only wait and see what the court itself makes of it.
No, indeed. Well, Sam, I mean, I wonder, like you say, I mean, can you believe that even while delivering their case, the Israelis bombed Lebanon and committed another massacre in Khan Yunis at exactly the same time?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, but it is part of a pattern with them. You know, when the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly voted for a ceasefire, you saw a similar spike in attacks against Gaza. And this has a long history. You know, every time a U.S. Secretary of State in the past, when, you know, there has been some criticism of Israel, you know, they would go and say, you know, you really got to stop this settlement building, for example. And then as soon as they, you know, left Israel would announce that it was going to build a new settlement, a new colonial settlement on the West Bank, for example. So there's this pattern with Israel of any time a demand is made for it to abide by international law, that it immediately escalates. And you saw that with Netanyahu's speech. I really hope that the International Court of Justice takes a very good look at Netanyahu's speech following the case, where he basically said, no one, not The Hague, not anyone's going to stop us. Completely lawless statements.
Yeah, I mean, David, what's your prediction for the ICJ process?
Well, Sam's point there is the opposite one about it being completely lawless. And that's what we've got to remember here, that this is a state which isn't going to pay any attention even to the US. If it can get away with it, it will just ignore and defy the US. Of course, if the US did take serious steps against them, they would have to collapse. But they don't care about this. They see themselves as an imperial nexus themselves. They're not just as they would. They're not just the tail of the dog in their conception. They are there to expand to a greater Israel and take over, you know, much of what we now call the Middle East or West Asia. So what's going to happen, of course, in the case itself? I would guess that the court is going to say that there should be a ceasefire, and they're going to order a ceasefire. But this is a lawless state. I mean, you know, when the court makes these kinds of judgments, states may not comply with them. Mm. And if we were betting people, we would put all of our money on the fact that Israel will not comply with a judgment that there should be a ceasefire. But if there is a judgment that there should be a ceasefire, which I think there probably will be, then this will be a tremendous advance for the Palestinian cause. But it's only a tremendous advance in terms of ideas and the informational battle. There still has to be the question of what actually happens in Palestine. Mm.
Indeed. And Sam, you know, if that does happen, if there is a finding that Israel is committing genocide, there is also reports, aren't there, circulating now, that Britain and the United States could find themselves in the dock for their collaboration in the and for the facilitation of the genocide that's actually happening now.
Yes. Well, there was already a lawsuit from the Center for Constitutional Rights against the United States domestically. I haven't taken a look at the – I've heard of, but I haven't taken a look at the recent British case. If it's being done at the ICJ, it could well have an effect on Britain. You know, they don't have a reservation on the relevant article, Article 9 of the Genocide Convention, as the U.S. does. So that there could well be, there should be follow-up. I mean, hopefully what South Africa has done here will open up several doors for further avenues, legal and otherwise. It should bolster, for example, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. You could have the General Assembly asserting itself in a meaningful way. There are several things that should follow from this.
Yeah. And in a word, and very briefly, Sam, because we're almost out of time, I mean, what's your prediction? Are you optimistic?
I'm trying to be realistic. I'm reminded that Catherine Gunn exposed that the U.S. and Britain spied on U.N. Security Council members during the buildup of the Iraq invasion. So I don't know what pressure is being put upon the court now.
Right.
So hopefully rule on the merits.
Indeed. Well, we live in hope, and time will tell. But I'm afraid we are out of time. That's it for this week. So I'd like to obviously thank our guest, Sam Hosseini, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Muradi. Please stay tuned.
ماه رجب کسایی که میخوان اعتکاف برن توصیه میکنم که
My suggestion for those people who want to attend i'tikaf during the month of Rajab is to be to a mosque or a place where not many people know them. In other words, it's better to spend our religious worshipping in places where we have no friends or close relatives so that we can focus more on our spiritual perfection. The month of Rajab is a good chance to focus more on our worship to Allah.
هر کی اعتکاف نرفته اعتکافو برید یعنی به اندازه یه جمله تبلیغ دین رو بکنه
اعتکاف is seclusion in a mosque for the purpose of ritual worship. During the months of Rajab and Shaban, you can find many people who put their names in the list to attend 3-day period of i'tikaf. Even preaching about the significance of this month and their rituals has rewards. All in all, Rajab and Shaban are good preparing grounds for the month of Ramadan. Mosques and religious gatherings are a good place for more contemplation on our spiritual life. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech. This was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Muradi. To find out more about this program and other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
According to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the growing threat from the far right in American society is attributed to the growth of accelerationism, an ideology that seeks to destabilize the country and trigger a race war. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The US military has been infiltrated by white supremacists and insurrectionists, with experts warning a recent Pentagon report detailing dozens of internal plots to overthrow the government is just the tip of the iceberg. The Department of Defense released a report on 30th of November, revealing it has investigated 183 instances of extremism within the military, including 78 cases of troops advocating for, engaging in, or supporting the overthrow of the US government. But experts have told the Daily Mail that the figures were likely to be a significant underestimate, pointing to a 2020 Military Times opinion poll that showed a third of active service members had witnessed signs of white nationalism or racism among their fellow troops. Historians highlighted a litany of alarming cases in which both current and former army members have plotted to assassinate political leaders, bomb media organizations, and topple the US government. Many have never materialized, but those that do often have deadly consequences due to their military training of the perpetrators. Heidi Bayrich, co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, charged the Pentagon with not doing enough to root out extremists within its ranks. She told the Daily Mail, "If the military doesn't take this seriously, it means terrorist attacks will be more violent, more successful. This is a poison for the rest of American society. If we don't rip these people out, they're deadly." The Pentagon report comes amid a series of alarming trends of extremism within the US military. Over the past decade, a murderous neo-Nazi group has been founded by a former soldier. A growing number of plots to attack critical infrastructure in the United States have been hatched by current and former servicemen, while 18% of those charged in connection with a Capitol siege in 2021 have military backgrounds. In the wake of the January 6, 2021 riots, the Pentagon admitted it did not know how to deal with the problem of extremism within its ranks and ordered a military-wide pause to allow commanders a window to tackle this issue. Matt Dalek, a political historian at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., pointed out that radicalization has been a long-standing concern within the U.S. military. The most infamous example being Timothy McVeigh, the former U.S. Army soldier behind the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that left 168 people dead and injured nearly 700 others. More recently, a former active duty Marine and member of the U.S. Army Guard was sentenced to 13 years in prison in 2020 after he was charged with plotting a terrorist massacre of journalists and Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi. Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Hassan was found to have held violently racist views even before he joined the U.S. military, raising questions over vetting procedures. But Matt Dalek, author of Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right, said it was hard to tell whether a disproportionate number of servicemen held extremist beliefs due to a lack of data, but warned the issue was particularly concerning due to its potentially fatal fallout. Matt Dalek said, "There is a clear threat in people who are experts in weaponry, who have access to advanced knowledge about how to make bombs, who also have a radical view of the world that impels them to commit violence. That can be a pretty dangerous recipe." Heidi Bayrich agreed that attitudes within the military tended to reflect a rise in white nationalism in wider U.S. society, but she said, there appeared to be a disconnect between the Department of Defense's report and the Military Times survey, which she believes indicates a far higher number of military personnel are involved in extremist activity. Heidi Beirich, the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, said, "There was a long history of white supremacist groups encouraging their members to join the military so they could learn how to blow things up and be better with weapons, while also spreading their hateful ideologies. There are also concerns that younger service members can be susceptible to new ideas disseminated by those in leadership positions." The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the growing threat from the far right in the United States society is attributed to the growth of accelerationism, an ideology that seeks to destabilize the country and trigger a race war. Indeed, a report published by the George Washington University in September of last year noted the number of white supremacist plots targeting energy systems had dramatically increased since 2016. Founded by a former National Guard soldier who had a picture of fellow veteran and Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh on his dresser, the neo-Nazi group, Atomwaffen Division, had already been linked to several murders, bombings and plots in the United States and elsewhere. It has also been a part of the growing trend of infrastructure terrorism, in which insurrectionists have targeted critical power stations around the country in a bid to bring an end to American way of life. According to a criminal complaint filed in Maryland, the founder of Atomwaffen Division, Brandon Russell, 28 years old, formerly a private first class in the National Guard, was arrested in February of last year over an alleged racist plot to completely destroy the power grid in the predominantly black city of Baltimore, Maryland. He stands charged with conspiring to inflict maximum harm by shooting at five substation operators by Baltimore Gas and Electric, which serves 1.2 million customers in central Maryland. He met his alleged co-conspirator, Sarah Beth Clandaniel, 27 years old of Maryland, while the pair were in jail. They were caught in an FBI sting operation.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Kind. And Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to all of you brothers and sisters, wherever you may be in the world. Welcome to your program, Islamic Upbringing, that is broadcast to you from IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Khalfan. Welcome to another episode of the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for accepting our invitation. We've talked about like the different dimensions of how to avoid having a lazy child. And previously, the last point that we mentioned was that we have to learn as parents how to instill, how to like keep them motivated. Yeah. And in this program, we want to talk about the different strategies of motivation. And like for one, we can talk about what kind of words, what kind of phrases, what kind of statements do I use to motivate my child?
Yes, that's a good thing. You know, they say there's a tradition that says that keep quiet if you don't have anything to say, but say it if you have something beautiful to say, then say it, right? And we should practice that even with our family, you know, not only with outsiders that we are good people, polite people. It's very easy with outsiders to be good, but within our family, how we behave, that's the thing that Allah really loves and really checks out on.
That's the most important
thing. So to our children, we never underestimate our children. That they're little, we can say anything to them. We are free with them. We have a right over them. We usually feel that we as parents have a right over them. We can scold them and everything. That's in their own, for example, you know, like in their own moods and times, for example, when they need to be disciplined. But as far as this is concerned, motivation is concerned, encouraging words will really help your child when he's having trouble in his studies. For example, you say, all you have to do is try your best. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is what? Try your best. Or, I'm so glad you asked me to help you when you needed it. I'm so glad. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. Or, I believe in you. I believe in you. That will really go a long way. That somebody really trusts and believes in me. Or things like, nobody is perfect. You don't have to say that so-and-so, if he brings the best grades and he's so intelligent. Nobody is perfect. You have something that maybe he doesn't have or she doesn't have, and vice versa. So don't ever feel bad about that, you know, you can't do better in your studies. All you have to do is, you know, you have to struggle. Then always remember this, you can learn from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. For example, if he brings the paper, he struggled, but the marks were not so good. Oh, this is the mistake. Next time we know that never to repeat this mistake. So you are telling him many things, you know, together. For example, mistakes of life also. We should learn from our mistakes, our past mistakes, not to repeat them again, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you persist, you will succeed. Mm-hmm. If you keep on, you will succeed. One day there has to be a time that Allah will show you that mm-hmm. you have succeeded. So never, never lose hope. Okay? And then also believe in yourself. If you believe in yourself, that means you have the confidence that you are what? A creature of Allah who is special. And Allah will not leave you just like that. He will help you. Believe in yourself. So, you know, don't take yourself for granted. You are important. You are very important. Not only to me, mostly to Allah. You're very important, more than I can ever imagine. So, you know, your child will feel empowered. Give him that power, the inner power that brings what? The motivation.
Can we go for a short break and we'll be right back?
Yes.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We have been hearing some very beautiful statements from Sister Khalfan in how to provide verbal motivation to your children, like things like saying to them, I believe in you, you believe in yourself. If you persist, you can succeed, you can learn from your mistakes, and so on. Anything else you would like to share with us?
Yeah, another point is respect your teen's independence mm-hmm. to motivate him.
What do you mean?
I mean that your teen is finding his way in the world, you see? So it means that he's discovering his own personality also, his interests also, and his own individuality. He's coming to know himself. You know, it's true that he's not an adult yet and you need to protect him, but the desire to become more independent is natural part of everyone's process. Everybody wants that independence. Like, for example, if he's in their room, of course, oversee what he's doing, but if they're in their rooms and they're reading their own, you know, books sometimes, or they're playing some things, or maybe some games, give them that space. Mm-hmm. Don't, you know, nag at them that, no, now, you know, no, leave this, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. No. Or don't even leave them completely that they should do everything that they want to. No, oversee, mm-hmm. always. But respect their independence also. So if, for example, you always have this over-control over themselves, you know, they will feel a kind of powerlessness in them, and they will feel hopeless. And then this leads to that feeling of, you know, not being motivated. You know, they'll feel that they are controlled always, and they need that independence, so they will feel less motivation in doing anything, even what they are interested in, which is very good, for example, for themselves. Some children, you know, they read. I know of one child who likes to read Quran a lot, and that's a very positive character, but he's always, always into Quran, reading, memorizing, studying about Quran. So the mother will say that, when will you get time to study your own things? You see? So sometimes, you know, like these tests and challenges are not only positive challenges, they're sometimes even negatively placed, sometimes positively placed. We feel, wow, if we had a child who's always reading Quran, it would make a heaven in our house, right? But that's not the case. Everything has a time, right? So the mother has to also look at how to deal with this kind of a
always
situation.
Always the mother has to do all that? And where is the father?
A shared experience. Always... For example, the time of the child. The father has to, for example, you know, with the effort of the parents, they have to enroll this child in a class of exercise, get him some friends, get him some other extracurricular activities that he could, for example, benefit from, so that the child can know that, you know, everything has its time and place.
Do you agree that, like, with regards to a daughter, and like the more that the girl steps into her teenage years, she has to get, like, she would need the help and support of her, of course, her dad too, but her mom. And with regards to a boy, an adolescent boy, he needs the care and protection of his father. You know, I know a family where the mother is very loving and caring, and she has like two sons. Now they're in their like 13, 14, 15 years, and the father is always absent, and the children have been brought up in a very feminine way.
Oh.
And like this is what happens when the father is always absent, and the mother has to be like, you do this, I'll set everything for you, your timetable, you're this, you do that. I mean, this is not an Islamic upbringing.
That's not. Unfortunately, the father is not playing his role, and he'll be accorded for it. He has to answer for that. He's answerable to Allah because he's lagged out in his duty. So the mother, mostly what she can do is that find some meal kind of oriented activity for him. For example, some good male friends, a community member, you know, who could help him. Like, for example, some kind of meetings that the boy could get to engage with his peers to learn, you know, mm-hmm. and things like that. Sports, for example, for a boy, teenage boy, it's so important to enroll him in sports because he's going through those kind of change in hormones also. And that would make him so tired so that no kind of evil thought would, you know, disturb him. Mm. So when he comes home, even after sports and eating his food and doing his homework, he'll be so exhausted that he'll just sleep. It's very important.
Let's go for a short break. We'll be right back.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. We've been talking about laziness and how parents have the responsibility of helping their children. And of course, all the time we're just mentioning the mother has to do this, the mother has to do that. I think we as Islamic experts, we have to like educate the men in our society.
That's
that
true.
It's
absolutely
your responsibility. Breadwinning is just a part of your responsibility.
That's right. Absolutely.
The main responsibility of upbringing is the responsibility of the father. You disagree with me?
No, both. The mother more because she's more at home.
What does
the father
say?
Is very important also. Quality time.
أنفسكم وأهلكم نارا. It's to the father or to the mother.
Yeah, the father, of course.
Exactly.
To his wife also. So the wife undertakes the job for the children. But now if the mother wants to continue her role as wanting to bring up a very good child, a pious child, what will she do? What has she got to do? She's just losing hope and just sit there and let the child do whatever they want?
Do double job, do double work.
Yeah, now if she's concerned mother, she won't even feel that double job. She will feel that she's doing something
she's
for the
human.
Sake of Allah. Of course, now she'll divide the work, right? Between, the, for example, the people whom she knows, who can help around, the community members, some friends, a good friend circle. Some fathers, of course, they have the love also, but they don't have the ability. Some fathers, they have the love and they have the ability, so they should give the quality time. Okay, they don't have that much time in their hands. Maybe they work 7 to 5. When they come, they're tired. Maybe the children are not home. They're in other classes, you know, because everybody has their own life. Or they're doing their studies, homework, exams, things like that. But the father should be clever enough to at least find that quality time.
Even 1 hour a day would be enough.
Yeah, more than enough.
Exactly.
Like nicely have, like meals are the best places of engaging into conversation and finding out what happened, you know.
Tea time after dinner.
Yeah, not tea time, only meals, a proper meal that will take maybe 1-2 hours.
Yeah.
After that, that family time. Just, you know, like it doesn't even take much energy. And it's also a pleasure. If you go and see, it's a pleasure for everyone.
Yeah.
The child, the father can find out so much things about the child. The mother even is engaging in, you know, like doing her duties. At the same time, she sees what interaction is taking place between the father and the child.
Right.
The father, the child even feels that, you know, my father is in tune of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
He can relate all those things. And the father has to patiently listen to all these things. So the mother should not give up on this idea. She should actually prepare this kind of grounds for special meals to be done, like at night, dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
The mother should have this, you know, preparation beforehand. Not that we'll just grab a dinner just like that with whatever there is, a sandwich or something
Poor
like
mother,
that.
Poor mother, she has to run around all day. She has to take the children
No, maybe
children
she can
to
have a light lunch.
And finally make a nice dinner for the husband to come and
no,
enjoy.
No, maybe a simple lunch, that would do. Maybe the child comes and has a simple lunch or whatever, some leftover, which is, of course, healthy. That's
uh-huh.
very important. And then it's mostly practiced if you go and see. And at night, the dinner time, that should be the zoom, the point of zoom.
Highlight.
Yeah, the highlight that when there's interaction taking place. When also you can point out to certain things that the father can solve. And we think that the daughter does not need the father. No, the daughter needs more the father also. Not only the presence of the mother. The daughter needs to be appreciated and loved by the father in such a way that even the father should find extra time for her to take walks, you know, together, to make her feel that she is so important, precious, beautiful.
Exactly.
And she's so loved. So that she cannot find that outside.
A boy would outside say, oh, you're so beautiful. And then she would fall for him.
Yeah, she would get carried away.
Exactly.
So that should not be it. The father should be so like active role for the child that this child completely trusts the father's choice when, for example, she gets some suitors.
Totally agree with you. Thank you so much. This is the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. Thank you so much, Sister Khalfan.
You're welcome.
And hope it was beneficial for all of you. Take care and all the best to you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.